When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I would be very careful about slinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Are we going legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
The Eagles remain undefeated, and the Cincinnati Bengals finally get a W on the board. Those are two of the big takeaways coming out of our third Monday Night Football doubleheader. Here to talk about that and so much more is Trevor Sikkema after finally getting his camera to work. That's why we're a little bit late today. So apologies for that. But what's up, Trev? How's it going?
All right, so you mentioned that the Eagles beat the Bucs, and then you throw me under the bus with the technical difficulties. We're starting off strong. Mm-hmm. This duo is starting off very strong this morning. I feel the love from you, Sam. But everything's great, man. Yeah. Excited to be back on with you.
It's just important to point out that it's not my fault. That's all I'm doing here. I don't even care who I'm throwing under the bus, just as long as somebody other than me goes under it. That's the main driving force here.
Survival.
Yeah.
It's the most important instinct for all human beings.
You can't fight that instinct, right? It's hard-coded into human beings. That's
true.
All I'm doing.
It's very true. It's true. I should have thought about that.
So anyway, we're going to get into that, and then we're also going to cast our eye forward to the teams that are currently already keeping an eye on the top of the 2024 NFL draft. If you've been with us for the first couple of weeks of the season, you know, we talk quarterbacks, we talk wide receivers. This week, we're going to take more of a holistic approach, a big picture view, and just look at the top 10 teams currently positioned for those draft picks. But before we get into all that, fall is all about the back to school and back to routine checklist, and the most important task on that list should be securing your family's financial future, starting with life insurance. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it quick, easy, and affordable to protect your family so you can get back to enjoying life. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget, with quality policies like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. Get your personalized quote in just minutes and then apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/PFFNFL. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Almost made it through the terms and conditions smoothly. But there's always a hiccup somewhere. Can't ever get through it.
That's the challenge, though. You know, it gives you something to come back to tomorrow to make sure that you absolutely nail the fine print, if you will, the thing that they speed up in the radio commercials.
Yep.
That's the real test.
That's what will get you. I mean, look, you strive for perfection, knowing that it's impossible to attain, right? But somewhere south of perfection, greatness lies. And that's all I'm really chasing for is one great ad read.
You'll get it. I believe in you. It won't be perfect.
No,
I don't believe in that. I don't believe in you that much.
No.
But it'll be great.
All right. So get into these Monday Night Football games. Philadelphia, Tampa Bay, the Eagles, I thought, looked a lot more like the Eagles for the first time this season. It was a little bit slow going at the start, but then they kind of hit a groove and pulled away and, you know, get to their 3-0 record and sort of looked more like the Philadelphia Eagles, racked up over 500 yards, won with relative ease, and did it apparently with half the team suffering from the flu.
Look, I'm going to be honest. This game went exactly the way that I thought it was going to. Like, and it went exactly the way that I figured it was going to even before the season began. Everybody kind of has that post-success hangover. It's very very rare that you get a team that either makes the Super Bowl or wins a Super Bowl that is able to just come out of the gate the very next year and just be that same juggernaut team. Like, it's always going to take a little bit of time. So for the Eagles to not absolutely hit the ground running this year, especially losing both of their coordinators, offensive and defensive, it makes total sense that, yeah, the team is really talented, but they're not blowing teams out of the water like we saw at the second half of last regular season. But they're still a really good football team. On the other side of things, Tampa, I tried to tell people, like, Tampa was going to be more competitive than I think Vegas Super Bowl odds or a lot of prediction shows were willing to admit. Like, they were going to hang tough with some teams, but certainly, if you take into account that they were down Carlton Davis, which is really important in this game going up against the Eagles wide receivers, and then Jamel Dean's in and out of the lineup with injury as well, Tampa doesn't have the offensive line to run the ball. And so unless Baker Mayfield plays mistake-free football, this is what you're going to get. You're going to get a team that, okay, 11 points scored. I figured it'd be a little bit more than that. You throw in a couple of the Mike Evans drops, maybe it's a little bit higher, but I figured the Bucs would score somewhere around 20 points, so if you take some mental mistakes in there into account, I don't know, man. This game kind of just went exactly the way I thought it was going to go. Philly's the better team. Tampa was a little bit more beat up. And really, Tampa cannot run the ball. They cannot run the football. And when they try to have balance in their offensive identity with a running game that is as poor as they have and an offensive line as poor as they have, it's just not going to work. You're not going to be able to beat some of these better teams in the league, and Philly showed that last night.
And I think Baker Mayfield, as he's been reasonably impressive for the first few weeks of the season, certainly relative to where his reputation had fallen to, I guess, is the way of describing that. Like, he's been better than that. He's been closer to the old version of Baker Mayfield. But I think he's still a quarterback where you don't want to be relying on him to have to do it, you know, all by himself. And by you just don't want him needing to, like, okay, the Eagles are rolling, they're crushing it on the ground, they're going to put up points, now we need Baker to keep pace, right? That's just not really going to happen. And as much as, you know, Mike Evans made that spectacular one-handed catch, had a couple of really nice plays early in the game, you know, he left some plays out there where Baker got the ball to him, maybe not the greatest ball location in the world, but could have, should have been caught. Mayfield has been spectacular on third down, and maybe if a few of those other catches or a few of those balls had been brought in, it might have been closer and they might have hung tough for longer. But I agree. I think eventually the Eagles would have eased away anyway, and the Bucs were just overmatched.
Yeah, I think your assessment of Mayfield is correct. Like, he certainly this year is showing that he can be that quarterback who, even in really important downs, you know, whether it's the red zone or third down, like, he can make a good throw for you. Like, he can give you those moments that are really nice. You just don't want it to be the entire game. And, you know, it's funny, you look at the stat sheet and he only attempted 25 passes. It felt like he attempted 30-something passes. Like, it felt like the ball was in his hand a lot last night. And you're right, you just don't want that to be the case. He is the kind of quarterback who will give you the play that you need every now and then, but it's not like some of the better quarterbacks in the league where, you know, every third down or every big opportunity, it's okay, this guy's got us. You need to be a lot more balanced, even for the best version of Baker Mayfield that we're seeing in the NFL. So given Tampa's injuries, certainly on the defensive side, not having Carlton Davis was huge, and then not having Jamel Dean was bad as well. Devin White, I mean, he was playing through a groin injury, which I didn't know last night, and I only figured that out when he got the interception on Jalen Hurts and they just, like, ran out of bounds before contact. Like, Devin White, I think, has some running back background in his football, like back in high school or whatever. Like, this dude could have played running back. And it felt like, if you go back and you watch that interception, Vita Vea just takes off. And, like, Vita is about to one-man blocking crew you like Sunshine in Remember the Titans, where Rev Harris is right behind him and he's just bowling people over like one after another. That was what it looked like Vita Vea was going to do in that interception. And then Devin just stepped out of bounds because he didn't want to re-injure his groin anymore. So I was kind of disappointed in that. But yeah, all in all, I do agree with your assessment of Baker. I think it was fine. Tampa's just, especially up front and especially on their interior offensive line, they're not at a place where they're going to be able to control the clock against really good teams. They could do it against the Vikings and the Bears. Like, we saw that the last couple of weeks. They were able to do it a little bit better, but not against the Eagles. No chance.
Yeah, they were fairly well dominated in up front on both sides of the ball, like both sides of the line of scrimmage. The safety where, you know, Nicholas Moreau gets in to make the play. Both Jalen Carter, who was spectacular in the game, and Jordan Davis. Like those guys, you hear sometimes about resetting the line of scrimmage. They reset the line of scrimmage 1 yard behind the goal line. And then Moreau was able to get through the gap and be the guy that eventually made the play. But like that Georgia duo of defensive tackles just took the interior for Tampa Bay and moved it a yard behind the end zone line. And it's like the goal line, uh-oh, that's a problem. And they did that multiple times in the game. Jalen Carter was an absolute wrecking machine. And then the other side of the ball, like I had a screenshot of DeAndre Swift who ran just in a straight line right up the middle of the field and was 15 yards deep before anybody touched him. They were opening some major running lanes.
Yeah, I don't want to take anything away from DeAndre Swift because I hate kind of prefacing it like this, but people are like, oh, look at the resurgence in Philadelphia. Our boss Chris Collinsworth could have a resurgence in Philadelphia behind that offensive line right now. So it's just kind of the Eagles imposed their will on a team that they should have.
Right.
And I think that that's what we saw last night in that game.
Another stat that they pulled out in the broadcast that was kind of amazing relative to Baker Mayfield. 8 head coaches for Baker, which apparently is the most in NFL history over a 6-season span.
Wait, 8 head coaches?
8 different head coaches Baker Mayfield has played for in the NFL in 6 seasons.
That's crazy.
Right?
I didn't realize it was 8.
Well, think about it. Like, I mean, last season alone, it was 2, right? So it only takes 2 of those years for somebody to get fired at the midpoint or him to change teams.
He had 5 different head coaches when he was in Cleveland? No way.
Yeah, like he started off with Hugh, right? And then it was Freddie Kitchens. And then, don't make me name them all, but he's been through them all. Stefanski now.
Well, I thought it was 6.
Look, I didn't fact check the broadcast. I just assume it's correct, right? Why would they lie to me?
Look, 6 is a lot anyway. So even if it's 6, 6 is too many.
Yeah. Well, last season he had 2, right? Because he went from Carolina to the Rams. And then there must have been a year, like,
Bowles is 3, yeah. And then Hugh Jackson, Freddie Kitchens,
4, 5,
and then Stefanski. So I thought it was 6.
There's got to have been another year. Like, did Kitchens make it through the full season, or did they get rid of him before the end?
Did he technically play for Matt Rhule?
Maybe. Yeah.
Before Rhule got fired?
Right. I don't know. Whatever. The point is, they said 8 head coaches in 6 seasons. Feel free to go to Wikipedia and track it yourself. Let me know. But that's part of the Baker Mayfield roller coaster, right? Like,
for sure.
Other quarterbacks have had to deal with a huge amount of turnover and coordinator and off in head coach, all those kinds of things, right? So it's not like it's unique to him. That being said, apparently 8 in 6 years is unique to him in NFL history and certainly can't have helped him settle into any kind of rhythm and get going and all that kind of stuff. Another element of that game, it was scorigami for those of you who partake.
It was indeed.
25-11, final score, the 1,078th unique final score in NFL history. That score has never happened before in the history of the game.
Wow. Congrats to Tampa. You know what? I'm going to count it as a win. Actually,
you should. Yeah. Another couple of things, like just notes I had in that game. I think Reed Blankenship is now becoming so important to that Eagles secondary.
Sure.
That dude is a baller, and he's important in both the run and the pass game. When they miss him, it's a massive loss in that secondary, particularly when you're down, you know, N'Kobe Dean at linebacker as well. Like you're missing a lot of the spine of that group. He made such a difference to yesterday's game.
Yeah, I agree. And then, I'll just give a homer shout out to Christian Izian, who is the slot/safety player for the Buccaneers, who they got as an undrafted free agent from Rutgers, who... I know Troy Aikman was talking about it in the broadcast last night, but he's a player, man. I mean, for him to earn that job out of camp, I'm not going to say it was the stiffest competition in the world because they had that spot open. They needed somebody to step up and fill that spot, but they didn't just give it to Izian because he was the only guy there. It's like, all right, well, I guess we'll give it to you. He truly earned that job. And that was the whole vibe from everybody that was covering camp down there. In August, and I think that he's going to be a major player for them. to already have, I mean, you just look at how fast that guy's playing already from a slot position that demands so much. Not only are you tasked with guarding all different receivers of all different shapes and sizes because offense coordinators are trying to use the slot and the space that comes with it to put their best wide receivers in the most advantageous situations. So you're sometimes going up against guys that are 6'3", 6'4" on one play, and then you're going up against guys that are 5'9" in the next play. Two totally different skill sets, and yet you're still kind of asked to stay in front of them and stay with them. So not only is coverage difficult, but when to blitz, when to disguise it, the chemistry that you have when you're in zone coverage, not to mention the versatility that you have as a safety player too. I just could not be more impressed with Izzian being able to play as fast and as confident as he already is in a Todd Bowles defense that is so aggressive, that demands that you are exactly where you are and playing as fast as you can. It's pretty cool to see him. So Blankenship, no dimming of his spotlight at all whatsoever. He was great in this past game. I totally agree with you. But just to give another shout out to a secondary member, Izzian's been great too.
No, he was. The last point to bring up, we've talked about this a bit in the podcast before, but I haven't heard your take on it, I don't think. Endless QB sneaks, double cheek push, tush push, whatever you want to call that play. There seemed to be no end of them in that game, and half the Twitter sphere is calling for the play to be outlawed. What do you think about that play?
I mean, it's obviously not outlawed, so any team in the NFL could do it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it just emphasizes more how great the Eagles are on the offensive line, because any team in the NFL could do this. Any team could literally just go to the all 22 of what the Eagles are doing and say, we're going to do this exact thing. But it doesn't happen nearly as much anywhere else in the NFL because nobody has the offensive line that the Eagles do. So I don't know, man. I'm kind of indifferent about it. I don't love that it exists, but it's hard for me to say that it shouldn't. They're just playing football. And when the reason why we see the Eagles do it so often is because the offense is good enough to put themselves in fourth and one, fourth and two, third and two situations. So it's just a really good offense and a really good offensive line that gets emphasized with a play that isn't outlawed yet. I don't know, man. I don't really have a super strong take here because I think people are just mad that the Eagles are having so much success with it. And that's simply just because they have one of the best offensive lines, if not the best offensive line in football. And if other teams had that offensive line, they'd do it too. So it's almost like build your trenches better. I don't know. That's kind of like my natural response to it, but they just have the perfect formula with that little rugby format. Are we allowed to actually cook? So, 'cause people call it like a rugby formation. It looks like rugby, but you are my go-to expert on all things rugby. So are you insulted when they say things like that?
I mean, I'm not insulted. It's just, it's not, it's just wrong. Like, it's factually incorrect. But it's fine. You know, call it whatever you like. I think we're a long way away from having the body of evidence to determine whether it should be banned or not, right? It's too new. Like, people are like, well, this is unstoppable. It's like, well, it's only really been around for a year, which is not really the length of time required to figure out if the league can find a way of stopping it, right? Stuff has dominated the league for a year in the past that doesn't exist anymore, right? The Wildcat was thought to be unstoppable for a period of time, and then the league figured it out and adjusted, and now nobody runs the Wildcat anymore because it doesn't work, because it's useless. This could happen next week. Somebody figures out the solution to this thing. Now, when you start breaking it down, I think that's less likely given the way the rules are and given the problems that they have. Like, I think it is a very difficult play to stop, but that doesn't mean that the league won't figure out solutions to it. And if we were to ban everything that for like 12 months looked unstoppable, like that just seems way too reactionary, way too knee-jerk.
Patrick Mahomes wouldn't be in the league.
Yeah, and we would be banning all sorts of like innovative, cool plays that somebody comes up with just because for a period of time it's unstoppable. Like, we were a few weeks away from banning same side motion because nobody can stop Miami doing it, right? That's not how this works.
That's kind of the mindset that I have with it. Is it's like, yeah, it's unstoppable, but when I look at it, when people are like, they should ban the play, I'm like, Why though?
Right.
Just because it's really difficult to stop? Because to me, again, to me, this just speaks more to the Eagles are better at building in the trenches than everybody else. This is part of their strategy. This is part of the rewards that you get to reap when you are this good in the trenches. So, hey, maybe there's somebody who's better and more into X's and O's than I am who can point out, like, no, actually, this play should not be allowed. And I'd be open to hear that argument. But until I do, I'm just looking at a team that's really dominant up front, and they get a free 1 to 2 yards every time they want to do a QB sneak.
Yeah, the only argument I think is, you know, if at the moment you're not allowed to assist the runner by pulling him forward.
Yeah, right.
So why should you be allowed to assist him by pushing him forward? Period.
Right.
Like if you're either allowed to assist the runner or you're not, and at the moment we're caught between two things. You're allowed to do it in one way, but not another way. So I think that's a reasonable argument. I just don't think the argument should not be you ban it because it's too good. It's too successful, right? At the moment, it's winning. It's converting almost every single time. Therefore, it must be banned. I think the argument is the rules are inconsistent. Let's square them away one way or the other. And that should be the determining factor.
Right. I'm with you.
Let's move on to the other game. Los Angeles at Cincinnati. The whiteout game, which is quite an impressive display, actually, for a team that, you know, is normally orange, black, et cetera, et cetera. That stadium was white. They did a pretty good job of getting the word out for Cincinnati. What were your big takeaways from this game?
My big takeaway from this game, and it's a takeaway that I just have for this season. I know that the Bengals won the game. Okay, yeah, they won. They didn't start 3-0. I think that that's probably the most important. But outside of that, Sean McVay is to wide receivers what Kyle Shanahan is to quarterbacks. You can give Sean McVay any wide receiver, and he will figure out how to make them a production factory, an assembly line of yards, targets, catches, and points. He is taking these players. The Tutu Atwell pick when it was made was one of the most scrutinized picks that we had in that entire draft. And it's taken a little bit to get to that point, but now he has completely found out how to use a guy who was basically just one-dimensional with speed and completely make that speed productive. He's doing the same thing with Puka Nacua. And I don't mean to take away things from these players. They've worked hard to get in this position, especially Nacua, who, from everything that we have read, has just really hit the ground running since he got in with that organization to be the most reliable receiver for Matthew Stafford that he can be. But McVay will get these guys the ball. His offense, especially with Matthew Stafford being the quarterback of it, is going to be able to get anybody the ball at any point in time. So that was it is astounding to me that the Los Angeles Rams are able to do this. They have on paper one of the worst rosters, if not the worst roster in the NFL outside of Matthew Stafford and Aaron Donald. Two very important positions, I realize that. But he is getting so much out of the rest of these players. And when they lost Cooper Kupp, everybody was like, oh boy, this is a sneaky number one overall drafted team. And maybe they still are. They're still 1-2. They're not 3-0 out here. But it's been incredible for me to see what McVay has been able to cook up with this group of receivers. So that, again, last night was a big standing point for me.
And I think they got robbed early. That Tutu Atwell play, that was a touchdown. They decided that his foot touched out, even though I don't think it did. I think they misinterpreted the rubber pellets, like the blank pellets that spray up. I think that looked like his foot going over the sideline or the shadow of it or whatever, and called him out at the 3-yard line when he wasn't. In a game the way that game went, you know, excruciating offense, low scoring defensive performance, that's a big touchdown to not give them right away. And I think when you mention this Rams team, it's bad on paper. I think for the first game this season, we actually saw that manifest itself in a real way. Like, that offensive line heading into the year, you're like, that group is a problem. And generally, this Rams offense has really struggled when their offensive line has struggled. This was the first game where that really showed up. And multiple members of that offensive line were just getting destroyed, particularly by Trey Hendrickson around the edge against backup left tackles. But for the first time, like, that Rams team, I think, was exposed for the relative lack of talent they have overall.
Agree. What about the Bengals side of things? What do you think of the Bengals?
I mean, Joe Burrow is obviously the big story, right? He plays through the calf injury. He looked, I think, good in terms of getting the ball where he wanted it to go, like understanding where to move. I think you could see visibly that his arm, which already isn't great, was weak. Like he couldn't right. drive off that calf. He was
yeah.
clearly sort of taking care of himself, and there were some passes he put in the air that didn't look great. But, you know, T. Higgins had a rough game. How many drops did T. Higgins have where the ball could have, should have been caught and wasn't? I thought overall Burrow looked solid, especially when you consider what he was dealing with playing through that calf injury, and the fact that Aaron Donald looked like Aaron Donald for the first time in a while and was just destroying that interior offensive line.
Yeah, it's that the Burrow is the ultimate story. I mean, I thought the Bengals defense was fantastic. They were great on third down. I thought they were great in the red zone. Like they were fantastic at getting pressure on Matthew Stafford all night and converting it even into sacks. So I thought that the defense played very, very well, which I figured that they would. This is a really good defense on paper and has been for the last couple of years. Burrow is the big story because of what you mentioned. When I was watching him play the week prior against the Ravens, that arm had no juice. And it's because he is already somebody who does not have the strongest arm in the world, that when you take away the power that he generates from his lower body, it gets even worse.
Yeah.
And on that Geno Stone interception, I'll keep going back to it. Sure, maybe you say to yourself, it's just a great play by Geno, or he shouldn't have thrown that ball anyways. When the ball was out of his hand, there's nothing on it. It's not even like he saw the tight window and tried to like put everything he had into that. It was a floater, man. And you go back and you watch that play and you watch his body. Sure, he's standing upright, but you physically see him like torque his back and his arms and his shoulders like even further than normal to try to get more power onto it, because he's not doing anything from the lower body because of that calf injury. So that was something that really worried me, because it wasn't enough against the Ravens, and I wondered if it would be enough against the Rams. It clearly was. They got a 3-point win, but I don't know how much. Like, does he really heal and get better if you continue to play him? That's my worry.
Well, that's
because if you can tell me, I'm not a doctor, but if you can tell me that if he just takes it easy every other day other than game day, that his calf will eventually get to, let's just say, between 80 and 90%, then I'd be like, okay, yeah, play him. But if him going through practices and going through walkthroughs and playing in the game and having to go through regular rehab as well, and obviously taking hits every game day and all that kinds of stuff, if that is basically going to say, yeah, his calf's probably not going to be better than like 60% the whole season, you might need to shut him down, even for where your record is. You might need to give him a couple weeks off and see where you are after that, because the Bengals need Joe Burrow at full health to compete in that AFC. And so that's just my big takeaway, even from after last night as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was the dilemma that we talked about on Friday with our injury guy, Vic Troja, on what Tyler is affectionately nicknamed the boo-boo breakdown. But Vic's point was basically like, there's no halfway house to this. Like, Burrow either needs to be shut down for a number of weeks to make this thing go away, to make it heal, or you're going to be dealing with last night's version of Joe Burrow for the rest of the year, because it won't heal if it's being, you know, if you're going out there every week and doing a full game on it, it's going to be what it is, which means that's the guy you're getting. And look, the other amazing thing about it was, like, he dropped back to pass 50 times. They didn't, you know, they didn't have a choice necessarily, but it wasn't like they were able to protect him and Burrow was just a distributor and didn't do an awful lot. He had to carry that offense, and he made some mistakes in there as well, but generally played pretty well. The other side of the ball, though, that the Rams, you mentioned their struggles on third down. I wrote down exactly what it was because it was wild. They started 0-6 on third downs, right? Then
not
they
great.
Get a conversion late in the third quarter, but it was negated. So then they actually end up going 0-10 on third downs before finally getting their first official conversion on that touchdown at the death, which ended up not making any difference whatsoever. So effectively, over the course of the game, the Rams basically could not convert a third down at all.
You know, you kind of have to convert on third down to win football games. Yeah. That's why people tune into PFF. That's why, you know, they sign up for the advanced data. I was just looking this up while you were talking because I was curious of the Bengals schedule because they're in a tough division and obviously they're in the AFC. So I was like, is there going to be even a place where you can rest Joe Burrow? If you are going to give Joe Burrow any time off at all, that's not centered around the bye week. It's actually these next 2 weeks. And it doesn't sound, you know, playing him against the Rams makes you feel like they're not going to sit him.
Yeah.
But they play at Tennessee. It's a Titans team that they should beat. And then they play at Arizona. And I get that Arizona's been scrappy. But if you are looking anywhere else in the schedule, it's rough. Seahawks, 49ers, Bills, Ravens, Steelers, Jags, Steelers again, Kansas City Chiefs, Cleveland Browns. Like, their schedule is littered with teams that are above 500 rosters, whether they're above 500 when they play them or not. But these next two games against the Titans and Cardinals are basically the easiest two games that they're going to have in a stretch. So if you're going to rest Joe Burrow at all whatsoever, it would probably be these next 2 weeks. But I don't think they're going to do it.
No, I don't either. I think their biggest problem is that all those games, no matter who they're playing, who wins changes whether Burrow's in the lineup or not. Like the Titans, yeah, Cincinnati should beat them with Joe Burrow. If Jake Browning is the quarterback, should they beat them? Probably not.
Like, Hey.
I'm just saying.
You're probably right.
Yeah. other guys that had fantastic games. We talked about Trey Hendrickson and the damage he was doing. That guy put up 10 pressures in that game. The league leader through 3 weeks is at 19. So that was a pretty impressive performance by him. Logan Wilson, spectacular interception. Like two interceptions, in fact. Impact for player for them. I thought overall that Bengals defense looked like it was supposed to for maybe the first time this season. Like, lost in all the Joe Burrow hysteria over the first 2 weeks has been like nothing else in the Bengals had been looking particularly good either.
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, that first week, it's the weather conditions were so crazy. You know, you're almost kind of throwing everything out of the window. Ravens game was close. They ended up scoring 27 in that win. But I do agree with you in large part. This is, to me, one of the better defenses in the NFL. And they're definitely going to have games where it just feels like they're suffocating the other team, especially when the Bengals play at home, man. I feel like home field advantage in Cincinnati, not to, you know, pander to PFF headquarters, but like they go crazy for the Bengals. And I really do feel like that environment is huge for them. So I don't know off the top of my head what the win-loss split is for the Bengals when it comes to whether they're at home or whether they're on the road. But I feel as though that defense really steps up when they're at home. So it was good to see that because, yeah, no matter what Burrow's percentages of health, like they're going to need that this year.
Byron Young also for the Rams, I thought had a really good game. Rookie edge rusher. The combination of him on the same side when it happens with Aaron Donald is just a ball of destruction for opposing offensive lines to try and deal with.
I was decently high on Byron Young going into the draft. I felt like I was one of the few people who was like, this dude can really play. Like, he had the athletic scores, but he didn't quite have the production yet. But he's pretty new to the game of football at that high of a level, even when he was playing at Tennessee, because he was at a different school before, which is much lower level competition. And so his journey, you could kind of explain why he hadn't broke out yet. Like, a lot of people look, because I think he's 24, 25 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
People go, okay, you still haven't broke out and you're 24, 25, you're playing in college. And there's context to believe that his best football could have been in front of him. So when the Rams ended up drafting him, I liked the spot because it was going to allow him to play right away. He didn't really have to fight too much in front of him in the depth chart. So it makes me happy to hear that you gave him a shout out there.
No, I mean, he was a fun player in the draft evaluation because he's one of the most twitchy, explosive,
yes,
like, ridiculous movement skills of any edge rusher in this draft. But he just clearly had no real idea what he was doing. Which,
right.
Okay, that when you combine that with some of the things you mentioned, right, already being 24, et cetera, that's not necessarily a great combination. But as you said, there are reasons for it. Like, his backstory actually can justify why he doesn't really have any idea what he's doing yet. Point being, if you find a coach that can figure it out and tell him what he's doing and help him along, and he puts that part of it together, all the physical tools are there. And so far, that looks like it's kind of happening. Like, he's made a lot of noise over the first few weeks. And, you know, we know the kind of impact that Aaron Donald can have inside of an edge rusher in terms of giving them opportunities to make plays and in the, you know, cleanup plays, all those kinds of things that other guys don't get. So I think you should be, everyone should be excited for what he can actually do over the course of not just his rookie season, but beyond as well.
I agree. I'm with you all the way.
All right, let's move on now and start looking at teams for whom the draft is already an intriguing proposition, right? We have, what, 1, 2, 3, 4 teams that are now 0-3 after the first 3 weeks of the season, and a bunch of teams sitting there with just the one win on the board. So let's start up top, everybody's favorite mock draft candidate right now, the Chicago Bears, after the disaster that has been that team, everything about it, and Justin Fields through the first 3 weeks. How do you imagine the Bears are looking at this draft right now?
Well, not only are they the most exciting because they're picking at one, but everybody can see up there as well, they own Carolina's pick.
Yep.
And if Carolina keeps playing bad, they could have two top five picks. I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility that they could have 1 and 2, which would be insane. And so, you know, let's just be honest. If Chicago is picking anywhere near number one overall again, they're not trading the pick this time. They're moving on from Justin Fields. They're getting a quarterback. It's the actual conversation at this point when it comes to the Bears are, is Eberflus out? Like, are we already moving on from him after 2 years? And the way that this roster plays throughout the rest of this year, I don't think that Ryan Poles is in danger yet. I really don't, because you need you truly need more time as a GM to even fairly evaluate stuff like that. But he's taken some swings, and obviously he's had some misses, as all GMs do when they are first starting out, especially. But to me, that is the big question. If you are so bad that you're picking number one overall, or let's just say even in the top three, because you're getting yourself either Drake May or Caleb Williams, do you want the coaching staff that has established this current culture in Chicago to then get a year with your new franchise QB? I would lean that you don't, because that stuff, winning attitude is contagious. A losing attitude and a losing culture is often a pandemic. Like, when you start to slip and not believe and become this franchise that does not believe in themselves, things get bad very, very quickly. And the only way that you really wash all of that out is when you get new coaches and new leadership in the building. So I often agree that it is unfair to only give head coaches 2 years. I think that head coaches really need 3 years minimum for you to correctly judge them. But unfortunately for Eberflus, he's on a timeline where things are going so poorly for the Bears.
Yeah.
That if they are picking another quarterback, I don't know if they're going to want that current regime to kind of like roll the dice on, all right, well, maybe you'll be good with this next quarterback because you weren't good for Fields. It basically comes down to how much they're putting the blame on the coaching staff versus Justin Fields at this point for the lack of production and honestly the lack of hope that that entire regime and organization is exuding right now.
I think there are times where the decision kind of gets made for you, and I think this is true with starting quarterbacks as well. Like the Zach Wilson discussion, that is eventually going a decision that is going to be made for Robert Saleh. As much as every single week he's going out there going, Zach Wilson is our guy, he's our quarterback, he's the guy that's going to be starting all year long, it simply will not happen. At some point, it will become too much, and Zach Wilson will have played his way to the bench, and he will have to make a change of some description, right? This happened with Marcus Mariota as well multiple times in the last few years. It's inevitable. Right now, the situation in Chicago is going so badly that you're going to have to fire somebody, right? That's just the way the NFL works at this stage.
Right.
If this is the way it's going to be from now to the end of the season, people will lose their jobs at the end of the year because there just has to be consequences for that. There has to be somebody held to account for the dumpster fire that is happening right now. And that brings everybody this kind of cathartic closure where you can go, okay, even if it wasn't really their fault, somebody has been burned at the stake for this, and now we can all move on. Doesn't matter if we got the right person. The point being, we exercised the disaster of the season, and now we all set off in a good direction, feeling good about ourselves. So if the Bears are what we've seen for the last few weeks, I think Eberflus will be gone. But the bigger, sort of more interesting point to me is, this is why I think giving Justin Fields this year made a lot of sense. Number one, it wasn't obvious that he was a worse option than Bryce Young or C.J. Stroud or Anthony Richardson. And after 3 weeks, I still don't think it's obvious, right, that one of those, any one of those things is the case. Richardson is, you know, still a work in progress, and the man's been concussed from running already. Stroud looks very good, but it's 3 weeks. And Bryce Young has been a disaster behind a terrible offensive line in Carolina with no receivers to throw to. So as much as the Fields part of it isn't working out yet, it's not like any one of those three guys has shown, oh, wow, we just passed on the greatest quarterback to come along in the last 10 years to do this, right? So
yeah,
it was at least a debatable decision anyway. You add DJ Moore in the process, and potentially more importantly, you get two first-round picks next year, which means if it does go catastrophically badly, you're already in a position to get whoever the QB is you want anyway, right? Even if they don't pick number one overall, they're going to have two top five draft picks potentially, so you can at least go and get the guy that you really want, right? They're in a position already to draft the next guy if and when it turns out Justin Fields isn't that guy.
Yeah, and the timelines for Chicago were I don't want to say off. Off's not the word. Maybe not as in sync as you would want with the rest of the roster, because Justin Fields, it was going into this year, it was still year three for him. You don't know if he's good.
Right.
Well, if he takes a little bit of a step forward, then you go, okay, he's taking a little bit of a step forward here. Maybe he will be at his best next year. That's year four of his rookie contract. Yeah, you have the fifth-year option as well, but you're already then thinking, dang, we've got a budget for a second contract quarterback at this point. And unfortunately for Chicago, neither of their trenches are at the point where they're in unison with the quarterback contract. So best case scenario, you were looking at Fields being good, but then having to pay him an exorbitant amount of money to then keep him on the team and hope that the offensive line and defensive lines have gotten better at that point. Because right now, we're multiple years away from the Bears' defensive line and offensive line being where they need to be to actually compete. And I think that that was something that was very much brushed under the table when people thought about the Chicago Bears this season. They were just like, yeah, 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 but like Fields year two, he's going to be way better. Look at all these receivers, everything. And you go, trenches aren't looking great. But nobody really wanted to hear that this summer. And I was probably guilty of that as well, not really emphasizing that as much as I needed to. But that to me also is a vote of confidence from almost just pressing the reset button entirely. New coaching staff in there, you get a new quarterback in there, which means you are resetting that quarterback contract timer, and that's going to be more in line to me with the timeline that it's going to take for you to build the trenches in Chicago as well, so that year three of that rookie contract for whoever's the quarterback next is going to be in unison with then the offensive and defensive lines being able to carry the team. Then you've got two more years of that rookie contract for that quarterback, playing at a very high level, hopefully competing in the playoffs. And then, okay, you're signing them to a second contract, but the rest of the team is at the point to where that contract and that money is worth it, because you are able to have that winning window open, especially in the early years of that contract, which is a lot of times when the guarantees are up for these teams. So to me, the timeline makes so much sense for Chicago to move on after this year, especially with looking at how things are going on the field.
Yeah, I think given where they're positioned now with these draft picks, it might be a rough year for Chicago, but overall, I think they're well positioned to capitalize on the benefits that will bring. Looking at the other teams that are winless at the moment, of the three, Carolina, whose pick is going to Chicago, and then Denver and Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that two of those three teams are not going to be down here when we get to the draft. I think as bad as things have been in Denver, I know that, you know, Miami just hung 70 on them and Minnesota have looked rough. I still don't feel that either one of those two teams is bad enough that they're going to be picking like top three, top five by the time we get to the end of a 17-game schedule.
I am more convinced that Minnesota would be than the Broncos. You know, I understand that like you said, like they just gave up 70 points to the Dolphins, but you know, fortunately for them, those points don't carry over, right? The next game starts 0-0. And I think that Sean Payton is too competitive of a head coach to not put this team in the right situation to succeed. So obviously with them starting 0-3, I think that their final record is going to be something like, you know, 6-11,
yeah,
you know, maybe 7-10 at best, it feels like, for the Broncos at this point. But I don't think they're going to be a team that's going to be finishing in the top five. It would take a pretty big collapse, given all the talent on that roster, for them to finish worse than that and finish near the top five. Minnesota's a little bit different, though, because Minnesota is, you can kind of look at it one of two ways. You can kind of say there's no way these turnovers continue at the rate that they are for Minnesota, and they're eventually going to pick up some wins here that are going to get them far out of the top five. But I also wonder what happens to this team if, say, 3 weeks from now, let's say they go 1-2 out of their next three games, right? If they're sitting here at 1-5, how many dudes, like how motivated are they to just like really be this big upset team at that point? All the conversation's going to be about, okay, this is Kirk Cousins' last year, move on from him now, just start the next guy. It's going to be, I'm not saying like these players are going to quit, because they never do, and that's not a thing that happens in the NFL. But I could see the wheels falling off in Minnesota more so than the other 0-3 team in the Denver Broncos. That's kind of what I'm thinking with it.
The Vikings would be a fascinating team to end up there, because they never do, right? They're almost always, throughout their history, too good to ever reset properly with that top five draft pick. They always win six games or more, right? And find themselves picking the fringes of the top 10 at the earliest, rather than where they need to be to get that new quarterback in the future. If they finally had that year where the whole thing just unspooled, everything went to hell, maybe they trade away Kirk Cousins to the Jets once they finally make that decision on Zach Wilson and actually end up picking top three and get to go after a new franchise quarterback for the first time in a long, long time. I mean, you know, Christian Ponder was picked number 12 or something. Dante Culpepper, I think, was the fringes of the top 10. I don't remember when the last Vikings quarterback selected that was like top five was. That would be a real historical moment for that team.
Yeah, and Questy's probably licking his chops getting to pick a franchise quarterback, you know, because he's probably absolutely in love with that idea. I was actually talking with my co-host on NFL Stock Exchange, Connor Rogers, who covers the Jets. He's a big Jets guy. And we've talked about the Kirk Cousins thing before, and I think me and you have talked about that on this show. The thing that it feels like makes the most sense for both parties involved is for the Jets to say, okay, you don't offer your first round pick at the beginning, but like basically saying we're operating like we did not have that first round pick, trade it to Minnesota, get Kirk Cousins, actually compete, get to the playoffs, set up a winning culture, and then you just let Kirk walk. Because if you let Kirk walk, then you're getting the comp pick back from him. And you're probably getting what? Third, fourth round comp pick, depending on the contract that he signs. And I still think Kirk Cousins is good enough to start in the league. So you're getting a third round comp pick because he's going to sign for massive money. So then you get a third round comp pick back to kind of recoup for the first rounder that you would trade. But ultimately, we had this conversation the other day. I don't think Minnesota does that, because I think for as much as Questy would love to just say, let's tank, we're not going to be good this year, give me all the good draft picks possible and I will rebuild this team, it doesn't exactly work like that in the NFL. And if they were to trade Kirk Cousins for, I mean, who's the backup? Nick Mullins? Is that who their backup is? Yeah. Like, what are you saying to your fans at that point? You would essentially have to openly come out and say the rest of this season does not matter to your fans. And I don't know if a multi-million dollar franchise is even allowed to do that. So I don't know how realistic that is, even though it would be cool and also make sense.
So Carolina is the other team I think that could be rough, but their draft pick is going to Chicago, so they're not really a team to talk about here. Of the other teams, like once you get beyond the 0-3 teams, who are the other teams that are going to be picking in the top five?
Raiders, I think, are bad. I think the Raiders are a team with a marginal quarterback and a head coach that does not give them the edge to win enough. The decisions that McDaniels has made over the last couple of years for Vegas have actively hurt the team, in my opinion. The Chandler Jones situation's one of the strangest situations going on in the NFL that it feels like nobody's talking about with him not playing. Tyree Wilson is not ready right now to be a difference maker in this league. It's basically just Max Crosby. And there's some nice players on that defense and obviously some nice players in that offense, but they're not coming together as a team. So I think they are going to finish in the top five when it's all said and done. I think Tennessee, oh man, I feel like Tennessee is another one of those teams that's probably going to finish at the top five. But I'm always wary of betting against Mike Vrabel because he's just gotten so much out of so little so many times before. But I think they're another contender, which makes for an interesting conversation, right? If Tennessee's got a top five pick and they have their chance to select a quarterback, do they do it? Do they go out and get a quarterback having Malik Willis, having Will Levis as well? I don't know. I think that that's an interesting conversation there. And then I think the other team that would kind of be in that competition would be the Rams. I know they're sitting all the way down at number 15 due to strength of schedule, but roster is still not very good when you compare it to most of the other teams in the NFL. I think McVay is a good enough head coach to potentially keep them out of that top five, but when you just look at teams that are sitting there at one and two, the ones that you would bet on to be in the top five, I would say the Raiders, the Titans, and the Rams are still those top teams to me.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Arizona have shown that they're probably a better team already than everybody was expecting them to be. I still wouldn't be shocked if they, if they're feisty all year long, but not actually good enough to win enough games. I know they shocked Dallas.
They're top 10 for me for sure. Yeah. I just don't know where in that top 10 they're going to finish now looking at how they've competed over the last 2 weeks.
Right. I mean, shocking Dallas shows that they're capable of beating pretty much anybody in the NFL. But
and they should have shocked the Giants.
Exactly.
Right? They should be 2-1 right now, which is crazy to say. But
yeah, but equally basically stopping scoring for an entire half against the Giants show how vulnerable that is as well. So they could basically finish anywhere is what I'm saying. But it wouldn't shock me if they were a team that was down there as well. I agree with you on the Rams. I think they've got the potential to have that kind of collapse. I think the Raiders is probably also a team that has. I think Tennessee tends to fall into that Vikings category of they're never going to lose that number of games. I do wonder if the Giants could unspool at that level. Like,
somebody just brought up their schedule in the chat. I'm looking up their schedule. Okay, they got Seahawks, Dolphins, Bills. No, it's not. That's not great. Commanders, Jets, Raiders. Okay, that's not too bad. Cowboys, Commanders, Patriots, Packers, Saints, Eagles, Rams, Eagles. It's not the worst thing in the world, but certainly, oh man, if they go 0-3 over these next 3 weeks, that's going to be bad for that team.
Yeah,
that's going to be tough. The wheels might fall off. So that's a good shout out by you. Yeah.
And then I don't really see any of the 2-1 teams unspooling to that degree, though. Obviously, we've seen that in the past where, you know, the Bears last year, right? They had their 2-1 and then didn't win a game since that point. Well, look, Steve's just hanging around the outside the studio. Not doing the show.
Not even doing his own show.
Yeah, not even doing his own show. Just standing here. Making, interrupting.
2-1 teams. You know, I think that Tampa could still be a team that finishes within the top 10, right? I think that they're sitting here at 2-1 and some people are feeling good about their direction. But I think last night kind of showed this is going to be a scrappy team, but Minnesota truly gave away that game against Tampa in week 1. Sure, they beat the Chicago Bears, and the Bears are one of the worst teams in the NFL, and I think that we see that right now. But you lose to the Eagles, and they're in a pretty scrappy division. Tampa's kind of a coin flip, right? I think that they're probably Tampa to me is anywhere from picking from 5 to 15. That's where I think that their range is going to be. But they are another one that could be within that top 10 that has a positive record right now.
Obviously, everybody is focusing on Caleb Williams. You know, at the top of this draft, we talked about other quarterbacks could force their way up there as well. Marvin Harrison Jr., the wide receiver, is going to be one of the top picks in this draft as well. It's also, from the sounds of it, a really good draft class for offensive tackles, which is usually a source of an area to target for teams that are picking in the top five. That's usually one of the areas that gets focused on.
Yeah, this upcoming NFL draft in 2024 is going to be a lot of fun because I feel as though over the last handful of years, things always get unpredictable when teams prioritize non-premium positions differently, right? Like Atlanta picking a running back in the top 10 or Detroit doing what they did with Jahmyr Gibbs and then And then Jack Campbell, right? It always kind of, drafts always tend to get off the rails when there's not enough for sure talent at premium positions to where teams go, okay, we just got to get good football players on our teams then. So if there's not a quarterback, offensive tackle, edge rusher, or let's say like lockdown corner, maybe even receiver on the board that they're happy with, they might look elsewhere and we might see a pick like that. This draft is shaping up to have a lot of talent at the premium positions, a lot of talent at quarterback, a lot of talent at offensive tackle, ton of talent at wide receiver. And I think that the edge rush group is probably a little bit less than those three that I just named, but still really nice talent at the top, some guys to covet in the first round. And so do we see teams this year get even more aggressive, knowing that there are premium position players that they want to go up and get? So I think that it's going to make for a very, very fun draft. I'm telling you, man, I'm already through 185 players in this class, and I've got guys who are sitting at 115, 120 on my ranking. So I'm like, I got to move them up. There's no way they should have a 115 next to their name. They're too good. And I just scroll up and down and I look at my big board and I'm like, I don't know where I'd put them. There's a lot of really good football players in this class. And truly, this year more than other years in the past, it's an exciting year and a really deep year that's going to be fun to follow and analyze.
So fans of these teams that are already looking to the draft, where do they got to go to check out all your stuff now that we're starting earlier this year and getting a good head start and all this stuff?
Ooh, I'm glad you asked, because we got a fun schedule that we are updating throughout the season, man. This upcoming week, so next week, starting on Monday, we're going to have a brand new mock draft, a quarter season mock draft. So I'll have a new mock draft that's coming out, full first round mock. But we're also updating the mock draft machine with team needs and also the current draft order. You can see that right now, but we'll be updating that at the beginning of next week as well. You want to check out the big board and all those players that I mentioned. We're updating that and pushing it from 150 to 175 this upcoming week too. So next week is a huge NFL draft week over at pff.com. Make sure you're checking it out. Bookmark the NFL draft tab, because we're updating the big board, we're updating the mock draft machine, we're updating the team needs, and we're having mock drafts and all sorts of articles that are coming out all the time. We're starting draft season way earlier this year because people seem to really enjoy whenever we put that out. So we're already cranking it out. Whenever you want to dip that toe into draft season, wherever you are, whether you're a fan of 0-3 teams or 3-0 teams, we're going to have you handled at pff.com.
Let's go. All right. That's our first toe dipped into this water. We'll be talking about the draft, though, all the way through on these Tuesdays with Trevor Sikkema. Myself and Steve will be back tomorrow with JT O'Sullivan. QB School will be on the show now, an hour later, so 11:30 Eastern, because JT's on the West Coast and didn't want the 7:30 a.m. wake-up call, which I think is reasonable. It's fair enough.
No, it's very reasonable. Yeah. I'm excited for that. I will be in the chat for that one. JT is one of the best. He's awesome.
Outstanding. So if you guys want to see that, check out it tomorrow, 11:30 on the YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts whenever it shows up later in the day. Thank you all for listening. Hope you've enjoyed, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.